Hi everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, giving you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Esther, who are we hearing from this week?
So this week I spoke to Giulio Bruno. He's the CEO at Time Out Group. And we talked about the brand reaching a milestone 50th birthday, the growth of their different revenue streams, including across different parts of the world, and how they stayed true to the Time Out brand across 315 cities. And he also explains why the print magazine is still a vital part of the business and how their unique approach to Time Out markets is their biggest opportunity next year.
But Peter, what is this first story and why is it so absolutely mad?
It's one of those what a time to be alive stories.
Yeah.
So basically, the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who there was a lot of people saying, oh, he's disappeared in Turkey. And the story's come out today that he's been killed inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, which, if that is true, is absolutely horrendous.
Yeah. You hear stories about, you know, how hard it actually is for journalists around the world to do their jobs. And yet, this sounds like it was straight out of a Le Carre novel.
Yeah, it's just insane.
I mean, how mad is that? I cannot think of a way to frame it without referring to, you know, Cold War espionage fiction.
Yeah, and this is a country that's supposed to be an ally. We send these people bombs and guns and shit. It's just nuts. The best thing I saw on this is a tweet from an Italian lady, Marina Petrillo. She says, isn't it funny how despite journalism being deprecated, belittled, distrusted, exploited, ridiculed, humiliated, restricted, underpaid, and made more and more irrelevant, killing journalists is still such a popular activity?
Yeah.
And it's just sad, man, sad. But we need to just watch and see what happens. Maybe it's wrong or maybe it's not true, but I don't know.
Yeah, scary anyway.
Scary.
So moving on then. Unilad has blamed Lad Bible for its collapse. So what happened with this battle of the lads and why are we seeing Unilad sort of falter and peter out now?
The number of people I said that was like, are Unilad and Lad Bible not the same thing?
Well, it's what's bizarre because there is a significant crossover in a couple of the characters involved in this story.
So I think just to get the basics, Unilad, which owns Unilad, funnily enough, and a couple of other viral brands, has gone into administration. And that happened, Thursday afternoon? They were finally tipped over. That they've got debts of about 10 million, half of which are owned to Lad Bible, which are a different company. And in a way, sort of some of this seems a bit inevitable, given that they went so heavily into Facebook. And when Facebook turned that dial down, like they all suffered. Like, I think we were saying a couple of weeks ago, something like this happening was kind of almost inevitable. But this story, I don't think we've seen half of this yet. There's quite a lot of dodgy going on between what's actually happened between Unilad and Lad Bible and why Lad Bible now want to buy off that debt.
I like that everything I've read about this is now framed as a sort of Game of Thrones style battle of wits, where you know, people on the Lad Bible side have sort of come in and scooped up the debt, effectively making them preferred bidder.
I've seen tweets from people who've said that they've been in the boardroom while this has been going on for the last 6 to 8 months, and they said that there's a lot more to this that is yet to come out as to why Unilad have kind of swooped, as to why Lad Bible has swooped in on this. They said they've almost been cornered into having to go into administration.
What's bizarre, I think, is that it has taken this long to actually get to this point for Unilad and Lad Bible. You know, we've always said, if you do easily replicable content and you do it on a site, you know, a platform like Facebook, which you don't own and can turn the spigot off whenever, then you are effectively just waiting for this axe to fall. And yet Lad Bible and Unilad have been going for ages. They've managed to outlast some quality publishers on there.
But what Esther says, right? That's not the action. That's not the full story here.
Yeah.
This isn't just about the platform play. This is some weird stuff going on here. You know, I think it's Jim Watterson wrote this piece in the Guardian. And he's talking about, so he quotes someone as saying it's a very good business that's been grossly mismanaged. And that, you know, there's that tax bill of £1.5 million and no one quite knows why. And there's this debt, the actual debt that Lad Bible bought, they bought from Alex Partridge, who was the founder.
Yeah.
They owed him that money because of legal action, because he was ousted in 2013. It really is like Game of Thrones. I mean, I've never watched Game of Thrones, but this sounds like it's got all the wheels within wheels.
Yeah, it does.
Game of Lads.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It shows how much of a business these sites became. You know, they talk about Alex Partridge in the article, in that great article you mentioned, Peter, And they talk about, you know, he was one of the first people with an eye to what platform publishing could do. And it's incredible that it actually grew from that, you know, based on misogynist, sexist content that actually continued well into its publishing.
I was just going to say, let's not forget the history of the type of content that these things came on. However much they try to distance themselves, clues in the name, guys.
Who's going to play Alex Partridge in the movie, though? This is a thing. Because there's definitely a film in this.
I feel like it's going to be Cumberbatch again. You know, he's already played... he's already played Julian Assange. I reckon he's going to probably end up playing Alex Partridge.
Sweepstake! But what I would say is, just because we think there's been mismanagement, bad management, whatever kind of management...
Skullduggery.
Unilad, allegedly. That does not mean that we think platform publishing is okay, guys.
And what are you basing this on?
Well, there's a great piece in the Verge, I think. Is it Next Web? Brian Clark's writing on, he says that Apple's move to shake up the newspaper industry, this is the whole texture thing and the kind of Spotify of news, he says that offers little upside. And he says it's a really good piece because he's like, have we learned nothing from Facebook instant articles? And he quotes the Columbia Journalism Review saying half the publishers that went on instant articles are now abandoned it. He says just because there's 1.3 billion active devices doesn't mean you're going to get 1.3 billion new readers on Apple News. There's only 60 million people using it.
What kind of state have we got to when we say only 60 million people?
Well, it's true, but 60 million of all the publications in the world is zip diddly. Yeah. And one of Brian Clark's points in this is exactly that. He said that what's going to end up happening inside Texture is you're going to get a repeat of the whole clickbait thing where people are trying to get attention. So he says the best case is that the deal looks like a dud. And he ends this article with the best line ever. Publishers, just say no.
But actually, this is because we were talking about the Slate piece last week, where Slate had actually revealed their figures from how much they make. Yeah, and it's the thing as well that even if you reach all of those 60 million people, that does not equate to half of what those 60 million people would be on your site. So focus on growing stuff on your own sites.
This is the thing. It's like you see these huge figures, you know, here is the total potential addressable audience if you come on here. And then you have to chop that down into, well, how many people actually read it? How many people actually then go on to, you know, consume it in a way that you can monetize? And how many will actually come back enough to be worth a damn to you?
Just say no.
Talking of chopping things up.
Oh, God. Wow. All right. So, yes, Meredith, who, you know, one of the biggest publishers in the world. So after its acquisition of Time Inc., it's cutting the overall workforce of this, you know, combined company in half. So this basically broke on Wednesday. And Meredith is planning to shed Sports Illustrated, Fortune and Money magazines by the end of 2018. That's kind of fine. But what's actually happening is they're effectively cutting 4,500 workers in one fell swoop. And a large proportion of those people will be the journalists, will be the content producers.
I think there's a little part of this, some of the articles around this were a little bit misleading in the sense that, yes, Meredith will be shedding 4,500 journalists, but if they find buyers for Sports Illustrated, Fortune and Money, they will go along with those brands. You know, it's Time magazine hasn't shed all those journalists. That rich guy has just bought them all and kind of moved them out of the Meredith ecosystem. I don't remember the name of the guys. Oh, that's it, the Salesforce CEO. I don't think it's quite as scary as it looks, but that they're undoubtedly going to do cost cutting and trimming and things elsewhere.
Which is to be expected. Yeah, every time that you see this, every single time it happens, you saw it in the UK recently with Mirror and Express Groups.
I mean, I think the big thing is, it won't all be editorial people. There's just distribution people involved. They've shut down contracts with some of the distribution companies that they had and moved them to Des Moines or somewhere like that. I don't know.
What I think is really weird is, and it is Des Moines, because I'm reading this article in the Des Moines Register. Not long after the acquisition, Meredith said that some titles such as Time and Sports Illustrated did not fit their traditional focus on female audiences. But I thought part of the reason they actually went for those brands in the first place was because it diversified their audience. It seems to me to be a sort of a case of one hand, or rather of them saying something ahead of the acquisition and something completely different afterwards.
They've said though that they've tried to look at the advertisers and the huge advertiser pool they have. None of them are actually interested in kind of shuffling across to that audience. So I guess if you've got a huge female-focused advertising group, you're going to have to look at expanding your sales teams in order to get any male focus. You're almost starting from scratch in that sense, in terms of the audience and who you need to get the money in on that.
That's certainly true. But if you're zeroing in on, you know, your audience, your, you know, your valuable audience, isn't women too broad to be, you know, incredibly valuable like that?
You know, I don't think it's like that though. I think it's more like cooking. It's not like women's magazines per se. It's more like they have a bunch of cooking titles, yeah, or craft titles or home, whatever.
They just
and then a ton of advertisers who want to reach women.
Yeah,
because girls like cooking.
Girls' jobs and boys' jobs.
Well, I was thinking about girls just want to have fun. I've got Cyndi Lauper in my head now.
Oh, God, now yeah. I've gotten... Well, you're lucky because I've got Theresa May dancing to
Cyndi. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Well, speaking of Theresa May, then, controversy relative... Well, today, in fact, because we record on the Sunday, was The Observer right to publish an op-ed from Theresa May? Accusations.
Why would
have been
they not be right?
Well, exactly, but it's accusations have been levelled mainly from people on the left, it has to be said, effectively saying, why has the left-leaning Observer chosen to publish what is effectively a scat, you know, a very slightly rewritten version of her speech at the
Conservative
Party?
Because she's the Prime Minister.
Yeah, sure. Maybe the execution of it could have been a lot better. You know, if you're going to publish a piece like that, frame it with arguments why she's wrong about this, you know, why she's, you know, maybe right about this, but that some of her arguments aren't particularly cogent. Or, as Peter, you said, open the comments up for it.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a comment. Well, maybe I wouldn't, actually. It would have been carnage, but... I don't know, Charlie Beckett just kills this argument stone dead in a tweet, which he's responding to an MP who says, why is centre-left Observer giving the PM call and mentions it's baffling or whatever? And Charlie Beckett says, this is a bizarre anti-journalism, anti-democracy stance. Why on earth shouldn't news organisations give people with different views a platform? Why is everyone so frightened of debate? I would love to see Corbyn being given space in the Telegraph. And he's just so spot on.
Yeah.
He's absolutely spot on. I'd love to play devil's avocado on this one, but I can't. I really can't.
This is exactly the thing about echo chambers, is that if you don't listen, or if you refuse to ever publish different points of view, you're never exposed to anything outside your own echo chambers. And Twitter's notorious for this. But if you read The Observer, this might be the only direct interaction you have with what Theresa May thinks all the time. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's even bigger than that, really, because it's almost, if you choose not to publish something like that when it's offered to you, it's almost like you're saying, no, we are scared that your rhetoric will be convincing enough to kind of eclipse our own, that our audience will suddenly go, oh, actually, you know what, she is right, let's all go and read The Express.
But also, this MP's argument is wrong, but I was going to say he's wrong for the right reasons, but
he's wrong for the wrong reasons.
He's wrong for good reasons. He says he wrote for The Observer in 2013 about the go home or face arrest vans that Theresa May sanctioned. But the point about all of this is, if she hadn't written for The Observer, he wouldn't have had the chance to go, oh, remember the 2013 go home or face arrest vans?
Yeah.
So getting this stuff out there gives people a chance to talk about it.
I think I've got an avocado, guys.
Oh, God.
On the grand scale of things, Theresa May is relatively uncontroversial. Hear me out. Imagine just for a second that this was Donald Trump publishing in The Observer. Would the response be the same to allow him to have that platform? Because the reason we've been anti him visiting the country and anti him appearing on our media and things like that is because his views are so abhorrent to most of us that we feel that he shouldn't have a platform on that basis.
So is
there an argument there?
You know what, though? It doesn't matter. I don't even agree with not having Trump in this country. Bring him over and let's show them the love.
But what I'm saying is, if The Observer published a piece from Trump, would we be a little bit like, why would The Observer do that?
No, I absolutely would love to see Trump writing in The Observer, because then again,
writing, but yeah.
open the comments.
Yeah. If you're not scared of rhetoric, if you know you're in the right, then you should be engaging like this and actually printing her, you know, rewritten speech. It's not a good news story. There's nothing new in there. It is literally just an op-ed that they chose to lead with. But yeah, exactly. Give it a platform.
Okay, well, that's that avocado sliced and diced. This week I spoke to Julia Bruno, who's the CEO at Time Out Group. They've just hit a milestone 50th birthday, so I started off by asking what they did to celebrate and what their secret is to the brand's longevity.
Well, we have done incredible things. I can start from the last one, which is we did a party in Granary Square last Saturday, over 3,000 of people, of our closest friends and family. It was a ticketed event, obviously, so incredible party. I mean, it was sold out within hours, and we had a lot of fun. We had incredible, I cannot name everybody, all the shows that were there, from drag queens to choirs to female wrestling to comedians on the river, a fantastic space, the Grand River Square. So we did that, we loved it, a lot of music, etc. We also had an exhibition in the Museum of Brands in London, which was fantastic, with the 50 years of the best covers of Time Out and how since 1968 to today. You know, we have people like Bansky or Tracy Amin doing covers for us and our own people, it's great. We also, I mean, we have done things attached to that, like we publish around the world, every magazine, obviously digital as well, publish like 50 best places, 50 top people, 50, all with the 50, so around the 50. So it has been around the world, beautiful covers, beautiful articles. In London we have this, the 50 best places, the 50 most iconic moments in those 50 years, and the 50 most people, interesting people, or whatever, cool people today, etc. So quite good.
And is there a secret to the brand's longevity?
Yes, there is a secret, but it's...
Can you tell us?
Yeah, I cannot tell you. Now it's not going to be a secret anymore. We have been true to ourselves since 1968. What we did then, what we do now, basically is the same. Finding, informing, discovering, inspiring people to go out, finding the best of the city, and inspiring them to go out and enjoy that city. And we have done that through editorial curation, professional journalists who go out there every day to, you know, sample place and food and music and events. And we did that 50 years ago, we do it today. And I think that being true to yourself and still being that ambassador of the city, that helping hand that shows you how to go out better, is part of our secret. And be consistent. There is a consistency when you look at, you know, this in this 50th anniversary, we have been looking at magazines 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and there, the content is there for them for the day. So.
And Time Out, I think, from what I read, it was in 315 cities and 58 countries. How do you keep that kind of that consistency, the quality and the authenticity across all of those areas? I think things like Time Out Dubai must be really, really different from Time Out London, Time Out New York. How do you kind of square that one?
Well, there are two ways. One, you mentioned Time Out Dubai, that's a franchisee. So we own the brand and the IP, but they manage that. And it's the same sections. We maintain the same branded, we maintain the same color, the same everything. But it's the local people writing that through global policies, if you want. You know, when we're talking about 350 cities, it's at 350 cities where we have content, we are present digitally in most cases. But it doesn't mean that it's like a site like London where you have hundreds of thousands of pages of articles, right, compared to a page somewhere else, which is the best things to do in that city or the best restaurants in that city. So, but when we put content in all those 315 cities, it's of the quality of Time Out. It's edited by Time Out. It's from the copyright to the look and feel to the technology that comes to build that is the same. And that's why we maintain that. And obviously there is a content strategy of how we go about content, how we write. We have very clear policies on the, you know, tone of voice, what we say, don't say. And our editors, and internal and so sometimes freelancers as well, all abide by those policies.
And do you have quite a bit of contact with those teams to kind of make sure they're keeping to those? Okay. Or do you just let them...
No. We have the global editor-in-chief, Caroline McGinn. We have then country editors, and then we have the local, you know, city editor, and then, you know, all that. So that the editorial, if you want, hierarchy is there for a reason, to be sure that you maintain the level of quality and the level of even how you present a product, how you write it. It's very important. So no.
And Time Out have managed to increase their revenue by 20% in the first half of this year. And I think it's fair to say that that's in a time when many similar businesses are struggling. And I know Time Out itself faced some problems last year. So what was the reason for the turnaround?
Well, the turnaround has been happening for 3 years, because last year we grew all year 23%, and the year before 19 or 20% as well. So very similar numbers. And we are still in the middle of the turnaround. We're still not a profitable company. So although I agree with you that 20% looks good compared to other people, compared to our own expectation, it's not yet good, right? Good will be the day that, you know, we become profitable, which should be, you know, not too far away. And although we are proud to be growing, you know, that other people are not growing doesn't make us feel better. You know, I wish that everybody was growing in this very uncertain world, because I still believe that professional media is a necessity today more than ever in all areas of the spectrum, you know, from news to entertainment, if you want. So the turnaround still is in the middle of it, so I wouldn't want to go and, you know, go hooray, because it's not there. But it's also a testament to all the effort that the teams are putting to grow that revenue in many other ways, not just the old, if you want, time out. Now that revenue growing through affiliate revenue, through e-commerce, through their time on market, through obviously digital advertising, which has grown very well. So there are several elements of that growth. It's not just one thing.
And will profitability be that kind of cut to profitability approach, or are you actually kind of making investments and hoping that those will?
Well, you could say that we have been cutting, but at the same time, last year we bought the franchises of Australia, Spain, Singapore, Hong Kong, a year earlier Portugal. So clearly we haven't been cutting when you are buying or bringing in-house companies, which with all the people and all the overheads, as well as the revenue. So it is more than that. It's, I know I don't want to use the word right-sizing, but it's about how do you focus on the lines of business that give you higher margin? How do you don't get distracted by doing every single thing, but be much more judicious about how you spend your time and your money, hence your money, and still have some more work to do. So no, we are growing, obviously 20%, and we're also making sure that our expenses don't grow together with our revenue, because that would be the problem. If you grow revenue and you grow expenses at the same time,
yeah,
then you never move, right? You know, they have to go like this, not like that.
Yeah. And Time Out itself started as a magazine, but the business, as you were saying, has now got a huge number of other ways it makes money. Is the print magazine still an important part of that, or does the future sort of lie elsewhere?
Oh, we love our print, and more these days than ever. I always said publicly that for us, content is platform agnostic, right? So we create content, professional content, and then we place that content, whether it's a magazine or the digital channel, the web, or even the Tamar Market. And we see content, you know, the food we create in a Tamar Market by one of our chefs is content the same as a review of a film is content. And when you look at content that way, then print has absolute a position, important position for us. We're very proud of our magazines. It allows us to contact the consumer in a very direct way, like in London, giving 300,000 a week of our magazines in the hands. So we're putting the brands that advertise with us in the hands of our consumers. We are putting the content in the hands of the consumer. And people want to, you know, still have that. It's like when I ask people, how do you read books? Do you buy them, the actual books, or do you go in some tablet or Kindle? And people are buying books because we still want that emotional connection, the touch and feel of the paper, and why not? And so for us, print is part of that ecosystem, and we don't see like one versus the other. It's all part of the same. Now, we'll have to do that well. We have to be sure that the cost of doing that are in line with what we expect. But the content is we don't have a team doing print and another team doing digital and another team doing
It's all under one umbrella.
Exactly.
And with distributing London, we're quite lucky in the sense we've got really good distribution network, but people buy all the tube stations. Is that quite as effective in other cities around the world?
Yes, and we have different ways. For instance, in New York, which we also have like 275,000 a week, we had more a mix of distribution in boxes, because that's very normal in New York, you know, timeout boxes that you have there, take one free. And then we distribute a lot through directly to hotels and cultural institutions, which we also do in London. If you go to Barcelona or Madrid, people and businesses and cultural institutions apply for free, obviously, to get a box there with all that that we fill every week or every month in the case of Madrid. So in every and then there is also some distribution in the hand. So there is, depending on the city, but yeah, I mean, distribution is expensive. So we always try to find ways of doing it effectively to reach the right consumer, but also that's costly, that is efficient.
And with all the different things you do, what does your revenue mix look like? So I can imagine that must be really interesting for a business like this.
So advertising today still is the biggest part of our revenue. Funnily enough, if you look at print advertising, only, quote unquote, only represents 35% or so of the sales of the company. So we have become already digital in terms of whatever is not print in terms of revenue. But when you took that digital advertising and print advertising, you are talking easily now 70%, 75% of the company revenue. Then you have e-commerce, when we sell tickets to things to do and places to go through affiliate programs mainly. We have our own events where we do our own events. We produce them like Movies on the River or that party that I just mentioned, or the Battle of the Burger.
Yeah.
And then that also has ticketing and also sponsoring. You know, somebody sponsors to be there, to be your partner for drinks or to be your partner for food or whatever it is. And then we have the Tamar Market, which is a very super growing part of the business that in Portugal is, you know, grew 50% revenue year on year. EBITDA is doubling year on year. Mm-hmm. It's the most successful and most visited attraction in the whole of Portugal, with 3.6 million visitors last year, and this year is even bigger than that. So clearly that revenue, opening the five that we are opening in the next 12 months, you can imagine what it's going to do to the revenue of the company.
Yeah. And e-commerce, you said it has been a growth area for you. Is this something that you think is unique to Timeout, or is this something other publishers could adopt?
A lot of publishers have been adopting that, you know, selling things that they talk about through links, through third party, etc. Everybody's trying to do that, and everything seems to be very incremental. I do a little bit of this, I do a little bit of that. The problem with that, as I see, the challenge, not the problem, is that then you end up with so many lines of businesses, all very small, that it's very difficult to manage, right? It's something that we are learning. So everybody could do that, but there is a finite number of things that you can sell to a person, and why would they want to buy it, even though if they're coming to you to read something, do they want to then buy something? In the case of Timeout, people come to go out. They say, what is the theater play? What is the best play tonight or tomorrow? What is a good restaurant or sushi around here? These are the kind of questions. So these are people who actually want to act. They want to go and buy something. And we allow them to, whilst they are on our site, to buy through us and do it efficiently and click, you know, like a couple of clicks. Then, of course, we're doing that and it works. But if you just strap anywhere, you know, strap on a link and say, buy something here, then probably it's not going to work very well. The question is how efficient you can do that, and do you get enough margin doing that?
Mm. And in terms of authenticity as well, you get, certainly in somewhere like London, there are a lot of kind of smaller businesses. You know, the best curry place might not be the big place down the road. It might be a small corner place. How do people who come to the site know that that's a place has been chosen for kind of what it genuinely produces, and not because they've paid you money to do it?
Well, first, people don't pay us money to talk about that, period. our content is completely independent. The reviews are done by professionals with a name and last name. That's their job, that's their life. So the last thing they're going to try to do is do something because somebody tells them, including me. We have editorial independence. And that's why, 50 years on, when you asked me at the beginning, why we're still relevant, because we are true to ourselves, because we are true to our consumers. And they see it. They will see that immediately. If you start selling, apart from, I know how can you do that? Anymore, you're going to sell a review. That's not a review then. That's something. That's an advertorial. And by the standards, you will have to put advertorial or promoted content which everybody does, but it's marked as promoted content. But our reviews have nothing to do with that. We don't review as promoted. Oh, we are promoting this one. It's going to give him 5 stars because somebody's paying. It doesn't exist mm-hmm. for us. It does. You know, you look at my face because, like, it's absurd for us, right,
yeah.
To even think that. So the editorial independence is key to who we are. We say that content still is king for us. Everything else that we do, the transformation of the company, will not exist if we don't have that incredible content that people come to Time Out to find worldwide.
There is a line of thought that says that places like TripAdvisor are sort of almost subsuming what Time Out set out to do originally. What makes Time Out different from, I think probably crowdsourced reviews is the best way to say it?
Well, you're talking to an ex-executive of TripAdvisor, right? obviously, they are the parents or grandparents of what it was user-generated content, right? At the time, the year 2000, if I recall, when nobody else was doing that. And that's great, and it has its place, and they have done a fantastic business out of that, and other companies like Yelp as well. But that ship has sailed years ago, you know, that's there. They have hundreds and hundreds of millions of reviews, and then you can have your view on how much it's not good or good or fake or not fake, you know, when you read the news. I'm not going to go into that. Our differentiation, completely differentiating from them, is that we have professionally generated content. So we are PGC, right? PGC. And that PGC that I've just made up at this moment.
That little certificate with that.
Yeah, I should trademark it, right? Is what it makes us unique, which is, again, to your first question, you know, why 50 years on we're still relevant. And that being that, having that editorial independence, having professionals who do this for a living, is that, I mean, the editor in chief told me one day, they said, well, Julio, let me explain it to you now. I'm going to be a little bit. He said, we eat a lot of crap, so you don't have to. Right? That's what a professional reviewer would do.
Yeah.
Go to all these restaurants and then, you know, try all that and then say, well, this is what I believe, this is great, or this has 4 stars or 5 or 3, right? Whereas a user may have an opinion based on, you know, I was happy that day, I love that place, they were a nice person, and oh, this is the best restaurant in the world. For you, it was in that moment, and that's very fair. But when you're talking professional review, they have, obviously they do this for a living, so there are elements that they choose, what is the kind of place, what is the kind of food, what is the expectation, how is this cooked, is it to the standard they should be, et cetera, et cetera. What is the atmosphere, what is the ambience, what is that? And that's the same in a play. When you could review a play, I love that play. Why? Because I love that music. Fine, but was the play good? Was the actor good? Why? What have they done? What is the body of work? Is the director somebody who has been doing? Is this, you know, a remake or something, or is actually a new angle that a professional can do? Whereas a user, no matter how, you know, super blogger or whatever, will have a very, maybe not as objective opinion as a professional who does that for a living. That's a big differentiator between us and user-generated content.
And what would you say is the biggest opportunity for the Time Out Group at the moment?
Well, we were talking earlier about the Time Out market and the transformation, and you were talking about how other companies transform. We are doing something that I don't see anybody else have done. We are taking an old publisher, converted into a digital media and e-commerce business and entertainment, and now going full circle and being a retail, going all through the brand Time Out. Time Out Market is what we call the best of the city under one roof. The one that opened in Portugal, we opened in Portugal in 2014. It is extremely, very, very profitable. It's the best attraction by visitors in Portugal, let alone in Lisbon. The chefs that we chose are the best of the city. And that is taking the Time Out of all into the new world, and this is this virtual circle of you're a consumer who goes to consume content in our website, the magazine, then goes to a market, eats the food, which is also content, then go back, etc., etc. And now we are opening 5 of them in New York, Miami, Chicago, Boston, and Montreal, all within the next year.
And they'll all be completely different as well, aren't they?
They are all. It's the same story, it's the same curation, we choose the people, it's like we invite them to come here, and then we take a share of the revenue, but we run it, we operate it, is our design, is our brand, is their names in the places, but it's communal seating, it's fantastic, and you are always having the best of the city, and we change them as it's a permanent, it's not a pop-up or anything, it's a permanent market. But it's also a cultural market, it's food and cultural. We have Cooking Academy, where you learn how to cook by the top chefs in the world. You have music events, you have concerts, you have things like that that make us very different. And we are opening 5 of them. That's our biggest opportunity. Next year, probably around 40% of the revenue of the company will come from the market. Right? So imagine the transformation of a company.
Yeah.
That is bold, that is new, but it's still being true to what Time Out is, right? The best of the city under one roof, which I like to say, now 50 years on, Time Out is the only global brand that you can breathe, eat, drink, and enjoy. That's very unique, right?
The last thing we ask all our guests is what the last thing was they read or saw which really affected them.
Oh my God, there are so many things. You know, the last thing that affected me, nothing to do with all this, was seeing live the potential election of the Supreme Court in the USA. Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford. And that was incredible. That was watching a version of Big Brother, reality TV, but also real. And it's shocking. It's shocking in many ways that I'm obviously, I don't think we have time to discuss, but it affected me in saying where we are today and how information overload of information and misinformation have become so pervasive and so complicated. And we see the things that affect the lives of people one way or another, and I'm just not, I don't think we have to discuss the topic, but only seeing that it was something incredibly, you know, affected my, I mean, it was incredible TV, by the way. I mean, I don't know how you could have a producer producing that, because that's incredible TV. Although I have to say that politics today, also in this country, are very much reality TV.
Yeah, yeah.
I have, so that's, you know, I could choose some others, things that we have seen also in this country as reality TV moments in the last week.
Yes, and dancing the Prime Minister comes to mind, isn't it?
Well, yeah, for me, but I mean, I love that one, by the way, because I think that shows an opportunity to let your guard down and show that. That amazed me more than anything else, right? But I think there are things there. I think this, if I have to choose, that's the one that I is very clear on.
Don't forget you can check out our back catalogue of previous speakers at voices.media, where we also regularly publish links out to our media-related work elsewhere. Additionally, you can all keep in contact with us at Media Voices Pod on Twitter, or by following us individually. You will be hard-pressed not to see us all over Twitter. We are basically on there all day.
And you need to sign up for our newsletter. We've been telling you about this for months now. Come on, get signed up. This week, you'll be able to read a little thing from Esther on her interview with Julia Bruno. We've got a list of all the stories that we talked about, so it's basically show notes in a newsletter. We throw in a quote of the week. And if you're already on the list, send it to someone else. They'll love you for it.
So if you know anybody that would make a really great interviewee, or you've got anything you'd like us particularly to talk about, do get in touch. All our contact details are on the website at voices.media. And we'll see you next week.
You're just here.
Hear us next week.
Okay.
We'll be in your ears.
I feel like you guys are doing a music hall routine.
Ta-ta.
Bye.
Bye.